Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Affney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. We're going to talk with our first guest, Bill Walton, a featured asset of this program, we like to think, and also the host of his own podcast television program, The Bill Walton Show. A man who's experienced both in Washington now as a very prominent figure in the conservative movement and prior to that in Wall Street, notably as the president and CEO of Allied Capital, enables him to provide some wonderful insights into challenges that we're facing from those enemies, foreign and domestic. And we're going to get into, in the first block of our conversation, China, as we often do. Bill Walton, it's good to have you with us. Welcome back.
Frank, as always, great to see you.
Thank you. Let me start by asking you, we had a fascinating webinar yesterday on the so-called civil-military fusion doctrine of communist China and what it portends for the rest of us. And the context of it, Bill, was, as we often wind up talking about, what does it mean that the Chinese are seemingly mobilizing every aspect of their society for warfare against ours, including making all of their companies, state-owned and non, support that war effort in various ways, including scarfing up technology and data and other resources for the party and the People's Liberation Army? On the one hand, that's all happening in China. And on the other, American capitalists, like those with whom you previously worked, the Biden administration and others seemingly are just determined to do everything possible to help the Chinese with their civil military fusion and war mobilization efforts. What's wrong with this picture, Bill?
Well, what's wrong with the picture is it forgets that America is a sovereign country and we have a lot of our own interests to protect. And, you know, as I mentioned before, America was all in on bringing China into the world economy, you know, 8-10 years ago, certainly before Xi became president. But now, in light of what we're seeing about a nakedly ambitious China, Wall Street and a lot of the major multinational companies seem to have not gotten the message, and they're continuing with their aiding and abetting what's going on in China. We're starting to uncouple a bit, interestingly, mainly because of Xi, or in part because of Xi trying to cut back on China's dependence on the United States. China's trade with the United States, the exports to the United States have dropped almost 40% in the last 3 to 4 months. And it's they're also seeing a similar drop in Europe. And so China is deliberately uncoupling. And, you know, what you and I've talked about, and we speculate that if you wanted to make yourself free from interdependencies, if you were going to war, one of the first things you do would be unlink from critical dependencies on your trade partners, and that's what they're doing. And we're
especially
not,
with respect to those supply chains.
Well, yeah,
Frank,
we've seen the headlines. I mean, right now, unbelievably, we've got a flu season, which happens every year, and we're seeing a tremendous shortage of critical drugs, including something simple like antibiotics. And there are shortages, particularly among children's flu, cold remedies and antibiotics, and people are wondering, well, gee, what happened? Well, all of a sudden, they're waking up to the fact that a lot of our supply, maybe half, maybe three quarters, maybe 80, 90% is indirectly or directly linked to China. And China has been going through its own zero COVID lockdowns, and they've been dispensing drugs to all the Chinese people. And so there are probably a couple things going on. China's using all the drugs for itself, but I think you've got to wonder whether they're strategically withholding from the United States. you know, maybe presaging what we're going to see if should there be a wider conflict. We may find ourselves without many critical drugs, and it's not just the generic ones like the antibiotics and aspirin, things like that. But think about heart pressure, blood pressure pills. Think about all the other pills that people take to save, to preserve their lives. We may see some of those go missing from the pharmacies.
And most of us, including the doctors who prescribe them, have no idea that they're manufactured in China. Our friend and colleague and the subject of several of our programs, yours and mine, Rosemary Gibson, has Yes. been warning about this for years. And we still find ourselves desperately vulnerable, just one of the supply chains that is being, it seems, constricted. And as you indicate, Bill, may well be much more so in the days to come. I wanted to ask you in particular, Bill, our friend and colleague Gordon Chang had a wonderful sort of introduction to this webinar. And by the way, you can see it at presentdangerchina.org, folks, and I strongly commend it to you. But he said, you know, right out of the gate, the United States is not at war with China. And then he added, but the Chinese Communist Party is at war with the United States. And it's that juxtaposition and the failure, as you say, for people who profit from aiding and abetting our mortal enemy, to be sure. They don't have the memo, or they don't want to see that this is endangering our country. I think that's really the bottom line, and we've got to have a corrective action. I was interested to hear the prospective chairman of the new House Select Committee on China, Mike Gallagher, say on, I think it was NPR yesterday, you know, we're going to have to selectively disengage from China. And most especially, Bill, he emphasized we're going to have to stop underwriting the enemy. And that's a message near and dear to our heart, certainly at the Committee on the Present Danger of China, of which you are an important member.
Well, you know, Trotsky said, I think it was Trotsky, he said, you may not be interested in war, but war is interested in you.
Exactly.
And that's where we find ourselves.
This is Gordon's paraphrase.
Whether we want to engage or not, we're being engaged with.
Indeed, we are. Bill, let me ask you about sort of more generally the state of China. There is now evident major shift on the part of the Chinese Communist Party and Xi Jinping's government away from this so-called zero COVID policy characterized by these massive lockdowns. It seems as though, as this is now underway, the disease is breaking out all over, and there are serious problems now with large numbers of people. They're still not, I think, being honest with us about the numbers of casualties and so on. But talk a little bit about what that's doing internal to China, as best we can tell.
Well, one word, chaos. You know, we talked about supply chain issues and shortages, and one of the things that is a big factor is that people are theoretically going back to work in factories that have been shut down because of the zero COVID policy. And now that that's been lifted, people are more or less going back to work. But almost like in the United States, there are an awful lot of people who are simply calling in sick. And so these factories are not being reopened. And a lot of critical materials, including those meant for the Chinese, are not being manufactured. So it's going to take a while for them to undo the damage. And I think the other interesting aspect of this is that they suddenly lifted this, and we've seen the protests, and the protests were as severe as China's seen since Tiananmen Square. And even though the Chinese Communist Party is cracking down, I think people are beginning to see in China that there are a lot of like-minded people who can't live under this coercive government. Now, whether this has got legs, you know, you just don't know, but it certainly weakened Xi.
Whether the legs will be cut up from under them as a result of this social credit system remains to be seen. Hold the thought, Bill. We're going to come right back with more with Bill Walton right after this. Thank you. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. During a dramatic webinar yesterday, China expert Gordon Chang succinctly described the existential threat of our time. He observed that the United States is not at war with Communist China, but the Chinese Communist Party is at war with us. This insight explains the otherwise inexplicable. Why did this country's governing and business elites persist in providing technologies, resources, data, and financing that enable our mortal enemy, the CCP, to wage unrestricted warfare against America? The principal reason appears to be China's successful corruption of key U.S. politicians and corporate leaders. By putting personal greed and, in some cases, ideological affinity ahead of the national interest, such figures endanger the rest of us, our freedoms, and the constitutional republic that is supposed to guarantee them. We must disengage from China, adopt a war footing, and root out those playing for the other team. This is Frank Gaffney. Welcome back. We are visiting with Bill Walton, the host of The Bill Walton Show, which you can find on various platforms. Strongly encourage you to take a look at it. It's very well done. We're always appreciative of his time on this particular program. And Bill, I hated to cut you off there, but we had to break. Talk a little bit about what the implications for us might be if it turns out that this chaos further intensifies Xi's sense that he needs to engage in what I think the political scientists call a bit of social engineering to maintain control.
Well, that would be one way to put it mildly. But, you know, I think we're seeing all sorts of laws at work here. You know, you be careful what you wish for, you may get it, or the laws of unintended consequences. And I think the analogy here is with Putin and Russia. You know, people have been trying for regime change, and I think we're seeing a weakened Putin, maybe more dangerous than a confident, successful Putin. And the same thing's true in China. And Xi has got a lot of internal enemies. He's still got a whip hand over almost all, but that the ranks are growing of people that think his vanity has gotten in the way of his common sense. And you know, to recollect something we talked about earlier, he was very proud of China's low COVID deaths. Well, we don't know whether that was actually true, but B, he certainly got international recognition for that. And so he perpetrated this lockdown week after week, month after month, almost into a year, and the valves blew off. And you know, it's hard to see that China's in chaos, but it's as close as it's been in decades.
And that may prompt him to look for ways to rally people around the party and around
start a war, get a war going. Always rallies the people, go to war.
Focusing on that external threat, indeed. Bill, let me turn to the domestic challenges that we're facing as a nation at the moment. You have been following closely, I know, the efforts to get this omnibus bill, as it's called, a massive legislation that is $1.7 trillion more in spending, as I understand it, and that would be fundamentally a vehicle, talking about lockdowns, locking in, at least, the budget, the priorities, the programmatic initiatives of the Democrats, even though that would be binding on a group that has been given the mandate to lead the House next year. Why is this happening now, and why aren't Republicans blocking it instead of voting for it?
Well, if you're looking for Exhibit A to show that Congress is irretrievably broken, you know, maybe never to return to health in our lifetimes, if then, $1.7 trillion added to the $5 or $6 trillion that this session of Congress has put in place during its inauspicious reign. It's 400 I exaggerate slightly. It's 4,120 pages, or roughly that, which is 1,500 pages longer than the last omnibus bill. And to put it into context, this is a bill that contains so many moving parts. It's like 12 bills or more rolled into one. And a responsible Congress would be negotiating each one of these bills separately. But because they couldn't reach agreement, it all got rolled into one that dropped on Tuesday night, I think at 2:30 a.m., for an initial vote that was taken to the floor on Wednesday. So members of Congress are voting on a bill that no one, except maybe a handful, well, actually none of them, even the handful, don't read it. Their staff does. Nobody's read this bill. And so if you look into it, it's got something for everybody. I mean, it's even got rent-seeking things like regulating the cosmetics business under the FDA. And you say, why would you do that? Well, you're doing it because if you're a big cosmetic manufacturer, you don't want any impertinent startups coming into your business. And so if you build a regulatory moat around the business by having the FDA approve new entrants, you keep people out. It's just filled with really bad stuff in Washington.
Yeah,
it's been, you know, page after page after page. There's some K Street lobbying firm that's got its hand in it, who probably wrote the language.
Almost certainly. And the 12 bills are, of course, the 12 appropriations bills, each of which is usually very voluminous. Yeah. And they're filled with fine print of special carve-outs or bonuses or benefits to certain interested parties. You're right. And not least, I guess there are a whole bunch of retiring senators who want... Yeah.
Shelby in Alabama.
Their piece of this pie and their legacies perhaps as well. Bill, it's a bad way to do business, that's for sure. And as I say, the thing that's particularly alarming to me is the Republican majority in the House will be essentially stopped from doing much in the way of real reprioritizing the budget and the policies it funds for at least the remainder of this fiscal year until the fall.
It renders them toothless. I mean, and we ought to be circulating a list of the Republican senators who voted for this. I mean, some of them are obvious, like McConnell and Mitt Romney, who recently assured people, according to Babylon Bee, that he promised he wasn't going to be leaving the Democrat Party. but there's some surprising ones in there, like Tom Cotton, who should know better.
Surprised at that, yes, indeed.
And
hey, but Bill, let me ask you this, because it's sort of central to the larger question. McConnell may be obvious and is clearly driving this train in the Senate. He is purportedly being opposed in doing that by Kevin McCarthy, the man who wants to be Speaker of the House. Now incoming leader of the Republicans for sure, at least for the moment. And yet there is a rumor going around that McCarthy actually has signaled to Mitch McConnell that he's good with having this omnibus bill take care of a lot of natty problems and votes that he'd just as soon avoid in the new session. Do you have any inside skinny on where McCarthy actually stands? And I guess the question is, if he is opposed to it, wouldn't he be doing more to stop?
Well, I think we've seen a lot of Republicans really do not want to be in the majority, do not want to take responsibility for leadership. I'd put McConnell in that camp. He's been good with judges, but everything else, not. And, you know, the thing about McConnell is he's got a power base that's really unassailable in the Senate. McCarthy, not so much, not even, matter of fact, it's not clear he's going to be Speaker, although the odds are 99% he will. But he's operating with a very weak hand, and he does not want to have to deal with a lot of recalcitrant members of his caucus. And so by handing this bill to him, Mitch handing it to him as a fait accompli, means Kevin doesn't have to do as much work going forward and show some leadership. So that it would be a cynical betrayal of the conservative voters who want to see Congress do something good? Yes, it would. Are we surprised? No, we're not.
No, we're not. Well said. Lastly, very quickly, we'll have in our next segment a specialist in taxes, Aaron Friedman served in the Treasury Department of the Trump administration for a time. Talking about global taxation, quick thoughts on this. We got 30 seconds.
Well, the idea behind global taxation is they want every country to charge at least a minimum tax so that corporations can't go to lower tax jurisdictions. And the higher tax jurisdictions don't want that to happen. You know, Ireland profited enormously from having a low tax rate. Janet Yellen's behind making a global minimum tax reality, which means they can ratchet up all the taxes collectively, individually, or not individually. And
unaccountably, I think, is probably the key.
Uncountably, yeah.
Unaccountably.
So it's a bad thing for U.S. sovereignty. We should be opposing it, and Janet Yellen is pushing it.
I thought you'd think so, too. We'll talk more about the details with Aaron Friedman momentarily. But Bill Walton, thank you for your time today, as always, for your leadership on so many fronts. Come back to us in the new year, if you will. We look forward to talking to you then.
I will. See you next year, Frank.
Yes, sir. Next up, we'll talk global taxes right after this.
And throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back, and I'm very pleased to welcome for the first time to this program, Aaron Friedman. He's a man of considerable accomplishment. He served as a staff member on the House Ways and Means Committee and in the Trump Treasury Department, also clerked for a time on the Israeli Supreme Court. He is currently in the private sector, but we're going to be talking about his views on a subject that I know are his views rather than anybody else's. His concern, which I share, is about a topic that is frankly new to me and perhaps to many of you as well, namely the idea that the Biden administration is, in addition to a whole host of other sovereignty-sapping, constitution-endangering global governance gambits, actually trying to foster some kind of global taxation scheme that would be, it seems to me, utterly at odds with the principle that was at the very foundation of our independent country, namely no taxation without representation. To talk about all of that, I'm delighted to welcome Aaron Friedman. Welcome, sir, to Securing America. It's great to have you with us.
Thank you, Frank. It's great to be with you. It's a real honor to be on the show.
Thank you. You've been publishing now in a number of notable places, the Wall Street Journal and Bloomberg's and Fox News and The Hill among them, about this idea. Describe it in layman's terms, if you would, and the attachment that apparently Janet Yellen, the rather dismal Treasury Secretary at the moment, seems to have to it.
So the administration is trying to advance a global tax code. So the tax rolls are a fundamental attribute of sovereignty. Each country sets its own tax rolls. And you know, it's hard to think of an attribute of sovereignty that's more important to that. The administration went to Congress and asked Congress to impose numerous tax increases. And even this Democrat Congress has rejected most of them. So to get around Congress, the administration, working with the EU and the World Economic Forum at the OECD, is attempting to impose a global tax code that they are basically boasting would leave Congress no choice but to raise taxes on American companies. And the basic way that it works is that if the Congress won't raise taxes on US companies on profits that they earn in the United States from business operations in the United States, from selling to customers located in the United States, they would transfer the right to tax those profits to foreign countries. So for example, if a US company has a subsidiary in France and Congress won't raise taxes on the US company, France would assert the right to take money from the French subsidiary of the US company on the grounds that Congress is not sufficiently taxing the American company. This is, in my view, is an end run around the Constitution that says only Congress has the right to raise revenue. Not only that, but it's that the House of Representatives, which is closest to the people, that's up for election every 2 years, they're the ones that have to originate any revenue measure, because the founders realized and appreciated that revenue is something that needs to be decided by the people. You can't just come in and raise taxes by fiat.
And that's really what this sounds like would be the practical effect. I guess I'm a little unclear. How would the French, in your example, reach into our country and grab those revenues? They're not present in the subsidiary, presumably. They're in bank accounts in the United States. And who would have the right to those revenues if it's income generated in this country rather than in France, for example?
So even though it's income generated in the United States, so long as in France, the French subsidiary has any cash lying around or any assets, the French would just confiscate that and say, look, the United States isn't abiding by our new global tax treaty that says you have to have an effective rate of 15%, which is just sort of the headline rate. The real rate, it's on book income. So it's sort of this new way of measuring tax. So even though the US nominally has a 21% rate, you could have a lot of American companies that have an effective rate as measured by the new global tax code, much, much lower than that. So you're absolutely right that France can't reach into the United States and seize the bank account of an American company. But if the American company has a subsidiary in France, they could just take the assets there.
I would think that this arrangement would be rather unpleasant to contemplate by American companies doing business around the world. And yet, I think in your writing, you've pointed that some of them, at least, are in favor of this global taxation scheme. How could they possibly see this as consistent with their, you know, operations, their planning, their budgeting and you know, resources that the company generates?
So I think part of the problem is there's this false sense of certainty that the international bureaucracies are trying to give the companies, sort of assuring them that they might have to pay a little bit more taxes, and maybe they'll pay more taxes to France and less to the United States, but on the whole, they'll get certainty. Whereas right now, a lot of foreign countries are unfairly auditing American companies, hassling them for various reasons. And there are these assurances being given these companies that if they go along with the new treaty, with a new system, that everything will go much more smoothly. I just think it's extremely unlikely that that would actually happen. Another factor, unfortunately, is that a lot of companies have become a lot more woke proponents of ESG, and they argue, well, part of ESG is we have to pay more taxes. There's this idea being propagated, which I think is absurd, that somehow American companies don't pay their fair share to foreign countries. This is a view of this administration, which I think is very radical. Even the Obama administration didn't take that view. They wanted American companies paying more taxes, but more taxes to the United States. The Biden administration seems to be taking the view that American companies aren't paying their fair share to foreign countries, and we want to force American countries to pay more to foreign countries.
Well, and there certainly seems to be in the mix, as I say, more broadly of this administration, the desire to build up supranational entities and to resource them, I think, as well. There's been talk in the past about having, you know, taxes that would be assigned by and raise funds for the United Nations, for example, and presumably for some of the operations. But this is a different campaign, I understand, but it seems as though it's sort of nestled in this same sort of mindset that whatever we can do that diminishes American sovereignty, diminishes American constitutional rights, diminishes even the revenues of our government, is a net plus as long as it helps build up the authority, the power, the oversight, the control even of these unaccountable bureaucrats, as you put it, and others in these agencies that are a far cry from the kind of representation that the framers had in mind for us, no?
Democracy is best exercised at a local level where people actually have power over their representatives and have a close connection to them. The more remote the government, the less representative democracy there really is. A lot of the international tax issues are connected. The World Economic Forum is heavily involved in this. The EU bureaucracy is heavily involved in this, as well as the OECD.
The globalists.
And they're trying to involve the United Kingdom as well. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot to be said for international cooperation when you have international multinational companies that have operations in different countries. You know, you need to have a certain degree of coordination and rules of the road, but it's unprecedented that they would now claim that domestic tax rules having nothing to do with international taxation need to be subject to international approval, and that there's this new standard, again, new international standard, new international law against countries having a low tax rate. It's just completely outrageous.
Let me ask you, and we've only got a minute left, Aaron, what we are confronting, it seems, is a miscarriage of the process as well as the constitutional grounding of all of this. As I understand it, there would be no intention on the part of the administration to submit this to the Senate as a treaty, for example, for its formal ratification, because it'd be unlikely to succeed. Is that the case? And this is, of course, something they've done on Iran and other things of late. Again, an affront to our constitutional processes.
So the administration has gone back and forth. At one point, they asserted they could do this administratively. More recently, they seem to be said that they could some type of congressional executive agreement that could be approved by just a bare majority. They know there's no way a treaty would be approved. What they're saying, they're trying to give assurances to other countries that, look, we boxed the Republicans in. They have no choice but to agree to this because otherwise the United States is giving up revenue. So let's just push ahead. And part of the problem also is that...
Aaron, I'm beg your pardon. We have to cut you off. We're going to come back to you with more on this in the very near future. Thank you for your time today and for your insights into the global taxation scheme. We'll be right back with more right after this. Thanks for tuning in to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney. If you find the content of this program to be informative and valuable, I'd like to ask you to consider playing a part in supporting the organization that makes Securing America possible, our Center for Security Policy. We call the center the home of the special forces in the War of Ideas. We feature such warriors daily on Securing America as they diagnose the dangers facing our nation, develop strategies for thwarting them, and work with other veteran national security practitioners, legislators, and the American people to execute those strategies. Thanks to our friends at the American Family Network, we're able to expand greatly awareness of the Center for Security Policy's efforts and their impact. Like the real special forces, our effectiveness depends on having the ammunition, in our case money, to perform our mission. Please consider making a tax-deductible contribution at securefreedom.org. Thanks. We're back, and I'm very pleased to say, in honor of Hanukkah, among other things, we have with us a marvelous representative of both the Jewish faith and a former representative of the government of Israel. His name is Ambassador Yoram Edinger. He's one of our go-to guys on matters involving the Middle East, and particularly the U.S.-Israel relationship. He is the author these days of a terrific online resource, the Edinger Report, which I commend to you all. And he's a guy that I wanted to bounce off of several of the takeaways from a really important webinar we did. I mentioned earlier in the program, one on China, but this one was on the U.S.-Israel relationship sponsored by our Center for Security Policy. You can find the video of it at securefreedom.org, and I encourage you to go there. Mr. Ambassador, first, welcome. Happy Hanukkah. It's good to have you with us, sir.
Happy Hanukkah, and also Merry Christmas and Happy New Year to you.
Thank you. Thank you, all of the above. Yoram, we had a very interesting and sort of wide-ranging conversation about the state of the U.S.-Israel relationship, and rather more, interesting differences on the characterization of that relationship at the moment. Some of our panelists, notably Carolyn Glick and Mort Klein, spoke rather powerfully about the trouble the relationship is in because of, it seems, a considerable hostility on the part of the Biden administration and what are called progressives on the left here in the United States more generally. On the other hand, Shoshona Bryan and Dr. Michael Doran spoke rather more optimistically about the relationship, particularly because of intensified cooperation between the U.S. military under Central Command specifically, which now has Israel under its area of operations, but also that the IDF has been exercising with our forces in ways that suggest that we may be now prepared to support Israeli action against Iran if it comes to that. Give us your sense of where we are on all of these things. I'm always interested in your take.
Well, the current administration possesses a worldview which focuses on diplomacy rather than military in dealing with rogue regimes. The U.S. has attempted to exercise the diplomatic option, for instance, against Iran since 1979 and has failed completely, where the diplomatic option has been leveraged by the Ayatollahs of Iran to bolster their anti-American regional and global terrorism. The current administration is engaged in pressuring pro-American Arab allies such as Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Egypt, while embracing and courting the Ayatollahs of Iran. On these issues, there is no, in my mind, no chance of changing the administration's position. However, on the other hand, there are much more important issues facing the military, the national security agencies of the U.S., and those entities are aware of the clear and present danger to the U.S., to global democracies coming from Tehran, coming from the Muslim Brotherhood, other forms of Islamic Sunni terrorism. Certainly, Russia and China inroads into the Persian Gulf. And when the national security and military entities of the U.S. look around trying to find a proper partner, they can find no better force multiplier for the U.S. than Israel. And in my mind, those are this national security concerns are the NBA league type of priorities, while the global worldview of the administration ranks such as a junior high school type of priority. And therefore, I expect, notwithstanding very, very real frictions between the U.S. and Israel on Iran and on the Palestinian issue, simultaneously, in my mind, for the sake of American interest, we'll see increasingly bolster strategic cooperation between the two countries, which are mutually beneficial to both.
Mr. Ambassador, the relationship between the United States and Israel will depend in part, of course, on with whom the American government is interacting on the Israeli side. Can you give us an update on where things stand at the moment with respect to the formation of a government by Benjamin Netanyahu? As I understand it, today is sort of the deadline for announcing that he's got a new coalition ready to go. Is that correct?
Well, he's expected to announce completion of the government, of the new government. He's going to make a special announcement to the president of Israel. But when it comes to U.S.-Israel, there's no doubt. The Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, he is going to have sole proprietorship over U.S.-Israel relations. He's been around for many, many years. He knows the halls of power, the corridors of powers in Washington and throughout the U.S. inside out. And he will set the tone when it comes to national security matters, when it comes to international relation matters, when it comes to expanding the Abraham Accords between Israel and the USA. And as far as I know, Prime Minister Netanyahu is aware of the fact that the U.S. considers Israel a major, major force multiplier partner, and this will be the name of the game.
Let's hope that's so, and that it is, in fact, the name of the game. We'll be talking more about the implications, particularly for some very untoward developments in the Persian Gulf, for exactly that point. Right back with more with Ambassador Yoram Edinger. Welcome back. We are visiting with a distinguished retired Israeli diplomat and very serious student of the Middle East, and particularly of the importance of that region, and most especially his country, Israel, to the United States, and therefore the importance of the relationship, the security relationship, especially between our two countries. His name is Ambassador Yoram Edinger. We're always delighted to have a chance to pick his brains. And Mr. Ambassador, it's good news that the Israeli government is coming together, and that the prime minister, who has tremendous experience, as you say, will be taking the helm finally with a mandate from the Israeli people. Let me ask you about a particularly ominous development, in my estimation, and I think that of our group yesterday in our webinar, in the Persian Gulf, namely the visit last week of Xi Jinping, the Chinese Communist Emperor, to Saudi Arabia, and a whole slew of deals that were done, and some that seemed to be very, very portentous in terms of the security relationship with the United States. I think the Saudis want us to believe that there's steady state on that front, despite this new rapprochement with the Chinese. And yet they're buying into this Huawei network, which the previous administration, at least, said very clearly was a showstopper in terms of security partnerships, if people did that. And I would assume that would be the case with the Saudis today. What's your take on this development, its implications for your country and for ours?
Well, it seems to me that the rapprochement, or the relative rapprochement, between the Saudis and the Chinese, in fact, the Saudis and Russia, is a classic case of a self-destructive U.S. Policy, which is driving America's allies in the Sunni Arab world towards the arms of America's rivals in the international arena and in the Middle East, China and Russia. The Saudis cannot be indifferent to the current policy by the U.S., which is embracing their number one lethal mortal enemy, the Ayatollah's regime in Iran, and at the same time also legitimizing another mortal enemy, and that's the Muslim Brotherhood. The current U.S. administration is disillusioning by assuming that they have a choice in the Middle East between Middle Eastern Arab regimes, which comply with human rights, and Middle East Arab regimes which do not comply with Arab with human rights. In fact, in the Middle East, there's no such thing as Western style compliance with human rights. The current administration is upset with the way Egypt and Saudi Arabia are dealing with the Muslim Brotherhood terrorists. They would like the Saudis and the Egyptians to launch a diplomatic option against the Muslim Brotherhood terrorist, which is detached completely from the Middle East. Such a policy undermines vital American interest. It generates tailwind to Chinese attempts and Russian attempts to get deeper and deeper into the Persian Gulf. Certainly, it undermines the survival attempts by Saudi Arabia and the Emirates and the Egyptians in face of domestic terrorist assaults. And let's not forget that we're talking about Saudi Arabia, which, while they do not have currently a peace treaty with Israel, but the Saudis have been the major engine behind the Abraham Accords. Without the Saudis generating such major tailwind, there wouldn't be the Abraham Accords. And that, sadly, has escaped the attention of the current administration in Washington.
Well, I think it's worse than that. I think to the extent that they have an animus towards the Saudis as well, it's in part because of their strenuous opposition, really, to these Abraham Accords. And I don't think it's just that they are, you know, a product of the Trump years. It's that it seems the whole idea that you could possibly have peace in the Middle East, peace between Israel and successive nations there, without resolving the Palestinian question, is anathema to this administration. It's just one of the things that has driven them, I think, to be quite hostile to Israel at the moment.
There's no doubt that this administration is focused on the Palestinian issue, assuming that the Palestinian issue is a centerpiece of Arab policy, Middle East policy, which has defied the real Middle East. But the major concern for President Sisi in Egypt and the Crown Prince in Saudi Arabia has been U.S. policy towards Iran, which has alluded itself that the Iranian Ayatollahs are amenable to peaceful coexistence with the Arab Sunni neighbors, amenable to responsibility sharing in the Persian Gulf, and amenable to detachment from their 14-year-old fanatic ideologies. The Sunni Arabs do not subscribe to such a gullible worldview, and that's the core, I believe, of the current friction between the administration and the Saudis, Emiratis, and the Egyptians.
I think you said 14 years. I think you meant 1,400 years, and I think you're absolutely right. This is deeply embedded. And I would just add that, in addition, I think, as you were saying a moment ago, the degree to which the Muslim Brotherhood has been penetrating and influencing this administration is another source of very real friction with those who recognize it is an enemy of, well, I think of our interests as well as those of the Saudis and Israel and so many others. Mr. Ambassador, we have to leave it at that. Thank you for your time today. I wish you the best for the holidays, and I hope you'll be back with us often in 2023. Thanks to the rest of you for joining us. I hope you feel better equipped to help us in protecting the country we love, and that you will now go forth and multiply.